A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those prompts where I read it and thought, yeah, this is going to resonate with a lot of people. He's talking about what it's like to be in the orbit of someone with a personality disorder. The specific pain of watching someone push everyone away, become more isolated and angry, and you want to reach out and say, can't you see what you're doing? Just stop, and everything gets easier. And then you hit the wall.
That wall is what makes this whole dynamic so uniquely maddening. You're not dealing with someone who's being stubborn in the ordinary sense. You're dealing with something structural.
And Daniel's making a specific argument here. He's not asking us to diagnose anyone or to make excuses for harmful behavior. He's saying there's an underexplored form of treatment here, not for the person with the disorder, but for the people around them. The victims, the loved ones, the people in the blast radius. And the treatment is understanding. Actually learning the mechanics.
Which is a genuinely counterintuitive move, because the instinct when you've been hurt is either to cut the person off entirely or to drown in empathy trying to fix them. Daniel's pointing at a third path, and I think it's worth taking seriously.
The word that unlocks all of this is one most people have never heard.
Its counterpart, egodystonic. These are terms from psychiatry that describe whether a behavior feels like it belongs to you or feels like an intruder. Something egocentric is in harmony with your self-image. It feels natural, justified, just part of who you are. Something egodystonic clashes with your self-concept and causes distress. Most of us, when we do something that hurts someone, we feel guilt or shame or cognitive dissonance. That's egodystonic. The behavior doesn't fit who we think we are.
For someone with a personality disorder, the maladaptive pattern is egocentric. It doesn't feel like a symptom. It feels like an accurate read on reality and a reasonable response to it.
And this is where the loop Daniel's describing becomes so painful for everyone else. You're trying to reason with someone, but you're not just arguing against their behavior. You're arguing against their entire internal architecture. The grandiosity of narcissistic personality disorder doesn't feel like grandiosity to them. It feels like an honest self-assessment. The fear of abandonment in borderline personality disorder doesn't feel like a distortion. It feels like clear-eyed vigilance.
When you say, can't you see you're hurting people? From their side of the wall, that's not a helpful observation. It's an attack on the only reality they know.
The defense mechanisms that protect that reality, splitting, projection, denial, those aren't conscious strategies. They're automatic. They're the immune system of a fragile self-concept. You challenge it, and the system treats you like a pathogen.
Which is why the advice on social media tends to oscillate between two poles that both miss the point. You've got the cut them off, go no contact, they're toxic, camp, and you've got the have compassion, they're suffering, camp. Neither one gives you a framework for what to do with your own pain while you're still in it.
Daniel's framing here is interesting because he's not making a case for empathy as most people use that word. He's making a case for comprehension. He wants to understand the engine well enough to stop taking the exhaust personally.
He's self-aware about it. He says outright, not everyone finds this helpful. Some people have no interest in learning about the mechanics of a disorder that hurt them. But for the kind of person who finds comfort in understanding how systems work, this can be healing.
It replaces helplessness with a model. You move from, why is this happening to me, to, this is happening because of a specific mechanism. That shift, from victim to analyst, it's psychologically protective. I saw this in my clinical work, actually. Not with personality disorders specifically, but with parents of children who had conditions that weren't going to resolve. The ones who did best weren't the most optimistic or the most emotionally expressive. They were the ones who learned the biology.
There's something almost stoic about it. You're not trying to change the thing. You're trying to change your relationship to the thing.
That's where Daniel's prompt gets really sharp. He's drawing a distinction between compassion, empathy, and pity. Empathy would be feeling their pain, which for someone who's been abused by a person with a personality disorder is a dangerous ask. Pity is condescending. Compassion, in his framing, is recognizing the suffering without absorbing it.
This is tragic, but it is not my fault, and I cannot fix it. That's a hard sentence to arrive at without some kind of intellectual scaffolding.
The scaffolding he's asking for is clinical, not pop psychology. He wants the DSM, the research literature, the actual diagnostic framework, not a YouTube video titled 10 Signs You're Dealing with a Narcissist.
Which makes sense, because pop psychology on this topic tends to be either pathologizing in a shallow way, or weirdly forgiving in a shallow way. Neither one gives you the structural understanding that actually changes how you process the experience.
What we're going to do here is take Daniel's question seriously as a therapeutic proposition. Not therapy for the person with the disorder, therapy for the person who's been hurt, delivered through knowledge. And the core concept we keep circling back to is ego syntonia. If you understand nothing else from this episode, understand that word and what it means for the person you've been trying to reach.
Because once you internalize that their behavior feels like self, not symptom, you stop expecting rational responses to rational arguments. And that expectation, that if you just explain it clearly enough, they'll finally see, that's the engine of the pain Daniel's describing.
The loop goes, they hurt you, you explain why it hurt, they perceive the explanation as an attack, they defend, you get more hurt, you explain more urgently, they dig in harder. Round and round.
The exit from that loop isn't a better explanation. It's understanding why explanations don't work.
Let's open the hood. The word itself, ego syntonic, comes from ego, meaning self, and syntonic, meaning in tune with. It was introduced by Freud, actually, though the modern clinical use has evolved well past him. The Wikipedia entry is surprisingly good on this. It defines ego syntonic as behaviors, values, and feelings that are in harmony with or acceptable to the needs and goals of the ego and consistent with one's ideal self-image.
Which means the person isn't being difficult on purpose. That's the thing that's so hard to wrap your head around when you're in it. You assume there's a moment of clarity available if you just find the right words. But if the behavior is ego syntonic, there's no internal alarm going off. No, wait, am I the problem here?
Contrast that with ego dystonic. That's when thoughts or behaviors clash with your self-concept. Someone with obsessive-compulsive disorder typically finds their compulsions distressing. They know the hand-washing is excessive, it feels alien and unwanted. That's ego dystonic. It creates internal friction, and that friction often motivates people to seek help.
The presence or absence of that internal friction is everything. It's the difference between, I have a problem, and you have a problem with me.
For personality disorders, particularly the cluster B ones, Daniel's prompt is gesturing toward narcissistic, borderline, histrionic, antisocial. The ego syntonic quality is baked in at the structural level. The DSM frames these as enduring, inflexible patterns of inner experience and behavior that deviate from cultural expectations. Enduring and inflexible. Those aren't adjectives describing a mood. They're describing the operating system.
Which is why Daniel's question lands so hard. He's not asking, how do I fix them? He's asking, how do I understand the architecture well enough to stop feeling personally demolished by it?
The architecture metaphor is the right one. When you understand that a wall is structural, you stop trying to talk it down. You stop interpreting its refusal to move as a personal rejection. It's just a wall. It was always a wall. Your mistake was expecting it to be a door. Let's take narcissistic personality disorder as the clearest example, because the ego syntonic quality there is almost total. Psychology today describes personality disorders as involving enduring patterns of inner experience and behavior that deviate from cultural expectations. For someone with NPD, the grandiosity isn't a mask they put on. It's the face they see in the mirror. When they belittle a spouse's achievements, they're not thinking, I'm being cruel. They're thinking, I'm the competent one in this relationship, and I'm simply stating facts.
If the spouse says, that hurt me, the NPD mind doesn't register that as feedback. It registers it as evidence that the spouse is too sensitive, or jealous, or trying to undermine them. The grandiosity is ego syntonic, so any challenge to it feels like an unjust attack. You're not correcting a mistake. You're assaulting their reality.
The defense mechanisms kick in automatically, splitting, where people become all good or all bad, no gray area. Projection, attributing your own unacceptable feelings to someone else. Denial, refusing to acknowledge facts that threaten the self-concept. These aren't strategies the person sits down and chooses. They're reflexes, the psychological equivalent of pulling your hand off a hot stove.
Which brings us to Daniel's question. Can't you see you're hurting people? The structural answer is no, they often cannot. Not in the way we mean when we ask that question. Because seeing it would require an ego-dystonic experience. A moment where the behavior feels alien and wrong. And the entire architecture of the disorder is built to prevent exactly that moment.
This is where the computer analogy actually earns its keep. Expecting someone with an egosyntonic personality disorder to recognize their behavior as pathological is like expecting a computer to run a program it wasn't designed to execute. The operating system doesn't have the subroutine. You keep feeding it commands, and it keeps returning errors, and you think you're just not explaining the command clearly enough.
The computer isn't being stubborn. It's not defying you. It simply doesn't have the architecture to process what you're asking for.
The tragedy, the actual tragedy Daniel's describing, is what happens to the person on the other side of that wall. You try to reason. You explain more carefully. You use I statements. You do everything the relationship advice tells you to do. And the response you get isn't understanding. It's escalation.
Because in their internal narrative, you've just become the enemy. Your attempt to help has been reframed as an attack. And the more you push, the more you confirm their worldview. That they're being persecuted. That nobody appreciates them. That you're just like everyone else who abandoned them.
Borderline personality disorder operates on the same structural principle, even though the content is different. The fear of abandonment isn't experienced as a distortion. It's experienced as a clear-eyed assessment of reality. When someone with BPD lashes out because they sense rejection, that fear is egosyntonic. It feels like survival instinct, not pathology. Questioning it feels like asking them to ignore a fire alarm.
The loop Daniel's describing. Push people away, become isolated, grow angrier. It's not a choice in the ordinary sense. It's the inevitable output of a system that treats connection as a threat and rejection as a preemptive defense. The person is lonely, but their own mechanisms make loneliness more likely, which confirms their belief that people can't be trusted, which tightens the mechanisms further.
This is where the victim gets trapped. You want to break the loop. You care about this person. You can see the isolation and the anger, and you think, if I just explain it clearly enough, they'll see what they're doing to themselves. So you try. And the loop doesn't break. It incorporates you.
Your explanation becomes the next data point in their narrative of persecution. Your concern becomes evidence of your condescension. Your patience becomes proof of your weakness. Every attempt to help is metabolized into fuel for the very thing you're trying to help with.
The clinical literature is clear on this point, even if it doesn't phrase it this bluntly. The enduring and inflexible patterns the DSM describes, those aren't bugs in the system, they are the system. And you can't debug an operating system by sending it strongly worded emails.
If you can't reason them out of it, and the loop just tightens the more you try, what does understanding actually buy you? Daniel's argument is that it buys you an exit, not for them, for you.
That's the pivot that makes his prompt useful rather than just another taxonomy of suffering. He's not proposing understanding as a path to fixing the other person. He's proposing it as a form of self-treatment. You learn the mechanics so you can stop being a participant in a machine that was never going to respond to you.
The hurricane analogy is almost too tidy, but it works. Understanding how a hurricane forms doesn't stop the wind, but it does stop you from standing on the beach asking why the hurricane is doing this to you personally.
It lets you build a shelter. The shelter in this case is emotional boundaries grounded in comprehension rather than hope. You're not white-knuckling your way through willpower. You're making decisions based on an accurate model of what's actually happening.
Daniel's careful about the language here, and I think that care matters. He distinguishes compassion from empathy and pity. Empathy would mean feeling their pain. And for someone who's been on the receiving end of abuse from a person with a personality disorder, that's not a healing move. That's a reopening of the wound.
Pity is worse in its own way. It puts you above them. It's condescending. And it doesn't actually help you process anything. It just replaces anger with a kind of smug sadness.
Compassion, in the sense Daniel's using it, is something more clinical. It's recognizing that the other person is trapped in a structure that causes them suffering, without absorbing that suffering as your own. You can say, This is tragic, but it is not my fault, and I cannot fix it.
That sentence, I cannot fix it, that's the one that takes intellectual scaffolding to reach. Because the impulse to fix is so deep, especially if you love the person, especially if you've watched them deteriorate. You think, if I just understood more, I could help. But the understanding Daniel's advocating for leads to the opposite conclusion. The more you understand the egocentric architecture, the clearer it becomes that you cannot be the one to renovate it.
Which brings us to the boundary question, because this is where the whole framework can tip into something dangerous. Understanding why someone cannot change does not mean you should tolerate abuse.
This is the distinction that gets lost in a lot of discourse around personality disorders. There's a version of understanding that becomes enabling. You excuse every harmful behavior because you've learned the clinical vocabulary for it. Oh, that's just his splitting defense mechanism. I shouldn't take it personally. Meanwhile, you're being emotionally demolished on a weekly basis.
That's not understanding. That's using jargon to rationalize your own victimization. The actual goal Daniel's pointing at is strategic disengagement. You understand the mechanism well enough to stop expecting change, and then you make clear-eyed decisions about what you will and won't accept.
The decisions are based on behavior, not on hoped-for transformation. You don't say, if you stop doing X, I'll stay. You say, if you do X, I will leave the room. The first assumes change is possible. The second assumes it isn't and protects you regardless.
That's not forgiveness. It's not even acceptance in the therapeutic sense. It's just accurate threat modeling for your own emotional life.
Which sounds cold, but it's actually the opposite of cold. It's what lets you stop burning fuel on a fire you can't extinguish. The sibling of someone with antisocial traits. I'm thinking of a case study that's made the rounds in clinical circles, spent years in rescue mode, trying to fix, trying to intervene, trying to be the one person who didn't give up. After learning the structural nature of the disorder, they stopped, not because they stopped caring, because they finally understood that their caring was being metabolized into more fuel for the same engine.
The relationship didn't improve, but the sibling's mental health did. And that's the knock-on effect Daniel's describing. For some people, this intellectual framework is healing. He uses the word comforting, which I think is exactly right. It replaces helplessness with a model.
You move from, why is this happening to me, to, this is happening because of X mechanism. That shift from victim to analyst, it's not just semantic, it's psychologically protective. You're no longer the confused person standing in the wreckage. You're the person with the schematic of what caused the explosion.
Which is why Daniel's preference for clinical resources over pop psychology makes sense. Pop psychology on this topic tends to give you labels without mechanisms. He's a narcissist. Becomes an identity category. Almost a slur. It doesn't tell you anything about what's actually happening in the cognitive architecture.
If you want the real scaffolding, start with the Wikipedia page on egocentonia and egodystonia. It's free, it's well-cited, and it gives you the core concept in about 10 minutes of reading. From there, the DSM-5-TR section on personality disorders, available through most public library systems, gives you the diagnostic framework without the sensationalism.
For someone who wants to go deeper, the clinical handbook space is where you want to be. Livesley and Larstone's Handbook of Personality Disorders is the reference text. It's dense, it's expensive if you're buying it, but it's the thing clinicians actually use.
For borderline specifically, Marsha Linehan's Cognitive Behavioral Treatment of Borderline Personality Disorder is foundational. Linehan developed DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy, which is one of the few treatments that actually has an evidence base for BPD. Reading her work gives you a window into the structural thinking behind the treatment, not just the disorder.
The APA's clinical practice guidelines are also online and free. They're written for practitioners, so they assume a certain baseline knowledge, but they're not impenetrable. And they have the virtue of being grounded in research rather than anecdote.
The key thing to remember with any of these resources is that you're not reading them to become a lay diagnostician. You're not training to spot narcissists in the wild. You're reading to understand a mechanism well enough that it stops feeling personal.
Let's make this concrete. Three things you can do with this starting tomorrow. First, and this sounds almost too simple, internalize the word egocentonia, not as vocabulary to throw around, as a mental model. When you find yourself drafting the perfect explanation for why their behavior hurts you, stop and remind yourself, this behavior feels like self to them. It's not a bug they're ignoring. It's the wallpaper. They don't see it.
That reframe alone can short-circuit the loop. You're no longer preparing a case for a jury that doesn't exist. You're recognizing that the courtroom is in your own head.
Second, build a mechanical vocabulary for what you're experiencing. This is the one that sounds cold but actually works. Instead of, he's so mean, try, he's exhibiting a defense mechanism that protects a fragile self-concept. Instead of she's impossible to reason with, try her architecture doesn't include the subroutine I'm trying to call.
I want to be clear. This isn't about excusing anything. You're not letting them off the hook. You're getting yourself off the hook of emotional reactivity. The behavior is still harmful. The difference is, you're no longer adding your own adrenaline to the fire.
The language creates distance. And distance, in this context, is protection. You're narrating the mechanism instead of living inside the injury.
Third, and this is the hardest one to execute, set boundaries based on behavior, not on hoped-for change. The trap is saying, if you stop belittling me, I'll stay. That assumes the belittling is a choice they can unchoose. It probably isn't.
The boundary that actually protects you is, if you belittle me, I will leave the room. Not leave forever. Not make a dramatic exit. Just leave the room. The boundary is about what you will do, not what you need them to become.
That distinction is everything. The first version hands them the keys to your well-being. The second version keeps the keys in your pocket. You're not asking permission to be safe, you're just being safe.
As for where to start reading, Daniel mentioned clinical resources over pop psychology, and I think that instinct is right. The Wikipedia page on egosyntonia and egodystonia is the best 10-minute investment you can make. It's free, it's well-cited, and it anchors the whole framework.
From there, the DSM-5TR section on personality disorders. Most public libraries have digital access. It won't teach you how to fix anyone, but it will show you the diagnostic architecture. And there's something clarifying about reading the actual criteria instead of someone's TikTok summary.
Avoid the books that promise to heal the narcissist in your life, or 5 steps to a better relationship with a borderline partner. Those are built on the premise that change is something you can engineer. The entire point of understanding egosyntonia is realizing you can't. Those books will just extend the loop.
Here's the question I keep turning over. Once you've done all this reading, once you've internalized the mechanics and built the boundaries, is it actually possible to have a relationship with this person that doesn't harm you?
I think for a lot of cases, the honest answer is no. The architecture doesn't change just because you understand it. And if the behavior is consistently damaging, understanding it doesn't make it less damaging. It just makes it less confusing.
That clarity has value. You stop asking, am I the problem? You stop running the tape over and over trying to find the moment where you could have said the right thing. You make the decision to stay or leave based on reality, not on a hope that evaporates every time you test it.
Making that decision without guilt, that's the piece Daniel's framework actually delivers. You're not abandoning someone who could have been reached if you just tried harder. You're responding accurately to a structure that was never going to respond to you.
The research trajectory gives me some cautious optimism, not for changing the person with the disorder necessarily, but for developing better tools for the people around them. Neural imaging work is starting to map the structural differences in brains with personality disorders. There's a reason these patterns are so enduring. They're not just psychological, they're neurological.
Early intervention is where the real hope lives. The earlier these patterns are identified, the more plasticity there is. But for adults already locked into the full architecture, the most effective treatment available to the people in their orbit might be knowledge.
Which is a strange thing to say about a relational wound. You don't tell someone with a broken arm to read about bone density. But emotional injuries from personality disorders are different. The injury is partly caused by confusion, by the gap between what you expected and what you got. Closing that gap with understanding doesn't heal the wound, but it stops you from reopening it.
If this episode resonated, share it with someone who's stuck in a relationship they don't understand. Not so they can diagnose the other person. That's not the point, and it's not something a podcast can equip anyone to do. The point is giving them a framework for their own healing, a way to stop taking the hurricane personally.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, chemists discovered that the iridescent blue of morphal butterfly wings contains no blue pigment at all. The color comes from nanoscale ridges that cancel out every wavelength except blue through interference, making it a purely structural phenomenon.
The butterfly is basically a walking physics experiment.
That's going to sit with me.
This has been My Weird Probs. If you want to send us your own question or just tell us we got something wrong, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.